Thanks for coming out, and we're very, very happy to have back with us Nathan Bell. Nathan Bell has been a professional singer-songwriter off and on throughout his life. On the road earlier in his life, then he took time off to actually work for the phone company, or whatever way you want to explain that. And then he came back to do it full-time a little bit ago, and that happened to coincide with the release of just an unbelievably fine CD called I Don't Do This For Love, I Do This For Love, which is a whole CD of songs that really are about work, about working class life. There's even a little labor relations thrown in. So Nathan is, in my mind, one of the finest artists going. And I think that you'll really enjoy Nathan Bell. One commercial for his father's work, Nathan has the wonderful heritage of being the son of Marvin Bell, who ran the Iowa Writers' Workshop for the longest time. And we had both Marvin and Nathan on campus at the residential college doing a joint presentation a couple years back that was just fabulous. And so that was a lot of fun. So I Don't Do This For Love, I Do This For Love, new songs of working and not working. Please help me welcome to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, Nathan Bell.
Thank you very much. We'll take care of the technical stuff here for a second.
Smith is living in Tennessee, shutting down a factory. It's a hard goodbye, but he does what he can. We drove that Chevy down to the levee. Things got rough, things got heavy. That's a hell of a weight to put on a man. John Henry swung the hammer down, bled steel into the ground, held back a machine with his bare hand. All the king's horses and the king's men couldn't put him back together again. That's a hell of a way to put on a man. All that you carry is all that you carry. It's all your own. All that you carry is all you carry alone. Years have come to this, loving scars, one near missing, knowing I'm worth more dead than the way I am. Hush, little darling, don't you cry, daddy's just counting the years gone by, and that's a hell of a way to put on a man. All that you carry is all that you carry, it's all your own. All that you carry is is all you carry along. Smith is living in Tennessee, shutting down the factory. It's a hard goodbye, but he does what he can.
Thank you. That is the one of the songs off the record, which was actually, it's my previous record by just a little tiny bit. I had an album of love songs ready to go, which is unusual for me. I don't really write them, and they're my own odd love songs, but they were love songs. And then we had an election, and I put out a different album altogether, which is the album that's out now, which is called Love is Greater Than Fear, 48 Hours in Traitorland. And it's a funny thing. I once read a story that Dylan said that he would have been perfectly happy to keep writing the kinds of songs he was writing, but then he would have to write them for the rest of his life. And that's why he changed directions. And it is funny if you feel an obligation to the world, you're kind of stuck, right? And you have to get really lucky to make a lot of money, and then then you've sold out. And I've always liked to say that I'd like to sell out once, just for a couple of weeks. And then after I buy what I need, I'll go back to not selling out. I did work indeed for the phone company for 20 years. I started with Bell South, and they were wonderful. And then we merged with some clowns from Ameritech, and it got worse every week and every year for about 8 years. And then eventually we parted ways. Ironically, when I was about 54, I don't think that had anything to do with it. But I think the fact they replaced me with a 28-year-old, you know. I knew what it felt like to be one of Donald Trump's wives. Write that down so I can use it again. Thank you. But I wrote this song on the way home in the car after I found out that I was no longer employed. It's on the newest record, but it could have easily been on this one. And I think it ties into the first song pretty well. On the long slide to the bottom, I'm sinking like a stone. Smoke 'em if you got 'em. There's a dead man walking home. Got a tattoo on my right shoulder and another on my left. One says I'll live forever. The other says this life will be my death. And I wonder if you'll love me, if you'll still come around. On the long way down, on the long way down. Well, money isn't everything, only buys a little hope. Till one day you find you hang at the end of your own road. And there's no wall of heroes for the ordinary man who's counting back to zero on his hard and empty hand. And I wonder if you'll love me, if you'll still come around on the long way down,
close to doing enough. And all I ever wanted was to live on the right side of love. Slide to the bottom, just a shadow that I cast. Smoke 'em if you got 'em. There's a dead man walking past, and I wonder if you'll love me, if you'll still come around. I'm
I really appreciate the people that came together to have me here. And this one, the song is, it's off the record. I don't do this for love. I do this for love, which is actually, the album cover has a great big safety zone words in the middle. So all through Europe, I would go to the radio stations to do the radio shows, and they would say, "We really enjoy your new album, Safety Zone." And I thought, you know, it's not, if you're a... if you're a graphics guy, you immediately look at this and see that, and I didn't see it. And I really, the design was done by a wonderful artist from Iowa City named Cheryl Jacobson. And I really liked the work she did, so I never even looked at it for that. And the title, of course, is A DJ's Nightmare. I don't do this for love. I do this for love, working and hanging on in America. And it's the I don't do this for love. I don't do this for love. It's readily obvious what it means once I explain it, which is that, you know, you don't go to work for the love of the job. A lot of the times you go for the love of the things in your life, right? Because work is a part of being alive. And for some reason, the Europeans find this hysterically funny. Because they have health care, right? And they think Americans are idiots, which it's kind of hard to explain why we're not. And I played the first shows that I played over there were right before the Great Orange One was elected and right before Brexit. And when I came back, I only had Brexit in my back pocket to keep from having to apologize the entire time. So I said, "Well, you did vote for Brexit." Now, all we're, yeah, we did. But they've come to the conclusion, as this country seems to be doing very rapidly, that when you have something to fight against, you coalesce, right? I mean, I can't believe the people that the clown has picked fights with this week. It's just, I don't know. It's entertaining if you don't have to live with it, right? So this song comes about, and I'm going to get the dates wrong, but I'm doing this for John partly because once he gets it in his head, it's stuck there. He's got a kind of a, it's like, you know, how when as you get older, you get songs stuck in your head and they won't go away. So by doing this song, I ensure that John will go to bed tonight frustrated that this song won't leave his head. And it's... it's loosely based about on the strikes that took place in the 30s that included the Flying Squadron. And I think it's Dick Morris's book that we talked about. And I had read about this, and the thing I found most interesting about it was that in the strike, in a situation of a strike, if you're not there, they replace you, right? And once these guys figured out that if they sat down next to the machines, it was going to be a whole hell of a lot harder to get rid of them. And it started something that, until Reagan, made sense, right? Now, you know, Reagan would probably just have pitchforks come in and move them. But this is toward that. And the state of Tennessee where I grew up, where I live, I grew up in Iowa. I've lived for the last 27 years. A lot of Tennessee came up here. A lot of Alabama came up here. So it all worked nicely together.
Couldn't find enough work to stay alive, so we left Tennessee on 25. Wife, two kids, and a working man, rolling north to the promised land. I did what I could, that's what I did. Working a press, third shift bridge. Was as near to hell as I'd ever seen. Where a machine's a man, and a man's a machine. Stamp metal. Where if the first day doesn't kill you, the next day will. Doesn't kill you, next day will. Well, Detroit filled up men like me. Playing in the Rust Belt Symphony, where the beat goes on and on and on. You're on time one day, and the next you're gone. Cause the line's a relentless son of a bitch. Brick a thousand men to make a one man rich. And nobody leaves with their hands clean. Where a machine's a man. A machine stand in the middle. Where if the first day doesn't kill you, the next day will. Where if the first day doesn't kill you, the next day will. For the next day, every day. The same day. Well, a man can burn, man can drown. Man can get tired and just sit down and refuse to do another goddamn thing. Where a machine's a man. And a man's a machine, stamp metal. Where if the first day doesn't kill you, the next day will. Where if the first day doesn't kill you, the next day will. Where if the first day doesn't kill you, the next day will. You can always find me here, you know, reflected in the glass. And I won't be the first to go. But it just might be the last. You can see the end in metal. It's by wind and dust. So you take another drink and listen as everything turns to rust. You can build whatever you want to build. Time will make it bend. You can love someone with all your will, still lose them in the end. When you're young, you're full of brave words, chemicals and love. Till one day you just stop talking and you can hear everything turn to rust. Trying to keep the water back, trying to stay afloat, trying like hell to save this house. It's the only thing I know. I might climb up on a roof one day, raise the white flag and give up. And close my eyes and listen as everything turns to rust. Oh.
Thank you. I want to do one from the aforementioned record again. This one is odd. It's kind of, when I was a young man, about 40 years ago, I used to drive through the Midwest to play blues gigs. And I've been through Cleveland and Detroit and Chicago in about 10 different economic phases, right? I was in Cleveland when, with the exception of the outer suburbs, Cleveland wasn't happening. You know, Cleveland's kind of wonderful right now if you pick your spots. And I remember Detroit quite fondly from the certain part of the 80s and certain part of the 70s, and then not so much so. And so I was driving through Detroit a few years ago, and I realized that I was driving on Edsel, and I realized that a lot more of it was lit. And there were a lot more big box stores, and there were a lot more stores, and there were a lot more blocks. And I recognize that Detroit is still a long way from Detroit, right? But it was the first time I'd seen so much light. And the people I know from Detroit are odd. They take a great deal of pride in being from Detroit. As a matter of fact, Smitty and I were down in Austin for South by Southwest a few years ago, and these guys got out of a van that had come from probably California with their they're clearly like I suppose it would have been a punk band in the 80s, but sincerely less genuine, you know. And they got out and they all had shirts, black shirts that said Detroit is everywhere. And I said, where are you guys from? And I think they said Santa Monica. And I said, don't wear those up north. And there's a certain element of that, a sort of pride that I like. And I've always loved the town, so this song popped out. And I don't play it much live, but here it seems appropriate. Good morning, Detroit. I saw you burning in my dreams, melting down to silver streams of metal on the ground. Good morning, Detroit. Wear you like a tattoo on my neck. One man's right is another's wreck. Running down. God, how I love this town. Where love rusts. Good morning, Detroit. It isn't funny, but I have to laugh at how they want you now in photographs while they sell you by the pound. Good morning, Detroit. I dreamed a dream of beating hearts, ground shaking as your engine starts and the wheels turn round. God, how I love this town. Where love rusts. I am actually, I grew up as the son of a poet, But the poet was the son of a five and dime owner. And so in my house, we talked more about work than we did about poetry. And my father used to say that there are two kinds of people in the world, people who worked and everybody else. And what I didn't understand, the class implication when I was a kid, right? I just thought it was about lazy people and people who worked hard. But one day I came in and he was watching Dirty Dancing on the TV. This was many years later. And I sat down and I said, "You like this movie?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I grew up with this." And I didn't really get it. And all of a sudden dawned on me. You know, this wasn't a movie about dancing. You know? And he's an interesting guy. And when I got a job at the phone company, and he found out what I made, because I made a lot more money than I deserved, he said, "You know, I'm really proud of you, and I think you now make a hell of a lot more money than I do." And the great thing about it was, for the first time in my life, I could buy other people's dinners, right? That was what was important to me. And I always jokingly say I'm one of the few songwriters in America who owns a house, right? Because that doesn't happen very often. But then there's another thing, is that we moved to the South in 91, and the South is very different, obviously, than growing up in Iowa and living in Boston, places like that, Chicago. What I discovered in the South was there was this thing that I didn't really know about. I guess I'd read about it when I was younger, but it hadn't stuck. The term walking boss. Any of you know what that is? Walking boss is the guy who has to do all the work in the field, who has to go and keep everybody working, but he can get paid shit. And he's just, they call him the boss, but it's like heaven. It's the worst title you can have because you're responsible, but you don't get anything for it. So the walking boss was, it's a very Southern term for in the fields for somebody who has to sort of be the capo. He has to be the guy who responsible for his own people's demise in some ways. And so there's a lot of pride in there in Southern culture for people who would turn that down and say, "No, I'll just stay here and work 13 hours in the tobacco field." And by the way, if you've never picked tobacco, don't. Anyone who's ever written a song about how much fun it is to be out in the field picking tobacco has never picked tobacco. Also, there are no songs about detasseling corn for a good reason. I did buy a bike with that once, though. They handed me a hammer, so swung it. Told me to ring that iron, so I rung it. Gave me a song to sing, so I sung it. But I'm never gonna be the walking boss. I heard my number when they called it. Didn't have a dollar in my wallet. They told me to haul ass, so I hauled it. And I'm never gonna be the walking boss. So I shot it. All the hell in the world, I caught it. And they punched my ticket when I bought it. 'Cause I'm never gonna be the walking boss. Carve my name in white stone. Tell the angels to carry me home. Then leave me to rot there alone. 'Cause I'm never gonna be the walking boss.
Are we still up here?
Is this... Oh, it came back.
Did I kill it? It has little, like... These have status indicators in here. And I'm just a little bit ADHD. So when they move, I have to actively ignore them. Like, hey, what's that doing? So I wrote this song a while back. It's also based on things I did as a teenager. My friends and I would get in a car and drive to Chicago and then drive to Gary, Indiana, and drive down the steel mill roads to look at the giant stuff and the big trucks, right? I mean, we were 17. We had gas and time on our hands. So we used to drive around down there, and because we used to drive there and because I used to go through there when I toured, that was another place I could see the changes as it took place and the sort of falling apart of things. I've been working some kind of straight job, as they say, for 45 years now. And I went to college. I went to Boston University. They let me in on the strength of my essay and something I'd published. And my C grades didn't seem to matter because we found some money somewhere. And I got there and I realized very quickly that I didn't want to be at college at all. And a couple of years later, I was working for a seafood company and dragging around the big barrels of fish guts that they put on the fields. They don't do it anymore. It's illegal because the bond traders that moved up to the northern part of New England can't stand the smell, and they got it made illegal to put on the field. But it's fantastic fertilizer, and if you can stand it for 2 weeks, you know, you got great growth. And all the, especially the herb farmers that brought herbs to the restaurants that I would also later work in, loved this stuff. It was fantastic. And so I would put these big, they called it gurry, these big 200-pound barrels, I kind of muscle them up into a truck, and then drive this sloshing truck of fish guts up the coast. And the first time I did it, no one told me that water moves when you go around corners. And I had never driven the truck before, and it also had a crawler gear, which I didn't know what a crawler gear was. I'd driven farm trucks, I'd driven tractors, but I'd never driven a truck with four gears, and one of them doesn't go past 3 miles an hour. So I cranked it into first, and I took off, and I never got anywhere. And I wasn't willing to shift because something was clearly wrong. So I, after being honked at, screamed at, and profanity-laced tirades from Boston cabbies, I pulled over, and it was the days of the payphone, and I called, and I said, "What the hell's wrong with this truck?" The guy said, "It's got a crawler gear." And that was all he told me, and then he hung up. So I'm like, "What the hell's a crawler gear?" So I got big in. It finally occurred to me, crawl, you know, and I got into first after, you know, starting it. And I drove it, and I came around a corner on the Mass Turnpike going out west at some ridiculously normal speed of 55 miles an hour, and the whole truck moved. I could feel it in the back, and I was up on two wheels going across the lanes of traffic trying to recover. And I recovered, and I didn't know what I'd done wrong. I had never driven a truck full of goo. So I drove to I stopped at the next rest area, and I got out, and I was kind of white. And for some reason, this guy had just gotten out of a 18-wheeler, looked at me and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "I almost tipped that thing over." He says, "What's in it?" I said, "It's barrels of fish guts." He goes, "Oh." He says, "You can't drive normally with liquid in the back of the truck." So I was saved by this guy. So I spent like a year driving around with the fish guts. I would work 14 hours a day. I was injured all the time. I was 19 years old. And I would come home at the end of the day. I'd take my clothes off in the hallway and put them in a plastic bag and hang them out the window. And I went through 7 pairs of shoes in a year because you can't. You know, it just disintegrates. I chewed tobacco so I couldn't smell it, right? And it was just, you know, it was kind of a ridiculous life. And every night I would eat a whole pint of ice cream and go to sleep. That's all I did. And one day my dad called me, and I picked up the phone, and I'm into the ice cream, and I can't lift my left arm because I've been doing this for 4 days in a row. And I've got my knee bandaged up because I slipped and tore a ligament or something. And my shoes are disintegrating around me, and I smell like fish. I mean, it's a real positive moment. And I pick it up. He says, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm doing okay." He says, "You know, I've had a couple of conferences I have to do this year. I'm going to have a little extra money if you want to go back to school." I said, "No, I'm fine." I hung up the phone. It's taken me 30 years to think, why did I say I was fine, you know? And so when I write these songs, they're not songs from observation. They're songs from having been in the middle of it. And what I've discovered from being in the middle of it my whole life was that it takes a long time to become a writer from that position because you're very sensitive to representing people that you know correctly. And because there's a certain language of, and I hate to use the word cliche because cliche sometimes isn't the right word, but there's a certain language about work that artists use. And it's not always, when you do it differently, it's not always seen as writing about work. And for me, a lot of work has to do with, and what you talk about in work has to do with how a person feels internally about their responsibility to their world and their life. Most of the guys I know, most of my friends, they would never imagine not going to work if it was available to them. And I don't mean that, this is not a welfare versus non-welfare argument at all. This is about people who, given some choices, usually take the choice that also includes involving other people and their sense of responsibility. And what I've discovered with those people is that they're generally more happy than everybody else. They might not be rich, and they maybe had a couple of surgeries, but they're happy. And this song, when I wrote it, was an attempt to sort of expose the ridiculousness of the nobility of work, right, and how it's presented often, but also present the person as somebody who needed that in his life. So hopefully it comes across. They call me Jesus of Gary, Indiana. I built the New Jerusalem. From crosses made of U.S. steel. On the shores of Lake Michigan. They shut us down in 84. Name a better business. And those of us who hope for more, we settled in and we settled for less. And it's a hardened man's amen when the switch won't throw. It's a hardened man's amen when the shift goes home. Well, I worked down at the local bar, roughing up the drunks and the jerks. He pays the bills most of the time. I wouldn't call it honest work. Sometimes I see myself in the glass, washed out by the neon sign. Sure don't look like the Son of God wearing his working clothes of mine. It's a hardened man's amen when the switch won't throw. It's a hardened man's amen when the shift goes home. They call me Jesus of Gary, Indiana. I built the New Jerusalem. Crosses made of U.S. steel on the shores of Lake Michigan. Thank you. I also had the pleasure of working in North Georgia just above Atlanta, about an hour above Atlanta for 3 years in an area that used to be the carpet capital of the United States. And it had really pretty much fallen apart. And I was working for, at that time, for the AT&T Corporation. And they sent me off and they said, go sell fiber optic services to these guys. I said, okay. And I would go in and they would say to me, well, you know, we're going to have to look at payroll. And if we make it through the end of the year, I'll give you a call. I did this for 2 years. And I don't think I walked into one place where they didn't say that. And I drove up and down this road. And on that road was all these different factories that had been tax incentive factories. And they'd all been there 10 years and left, which is what happens, right? It's like football stadiums and tax incentive factories are the two ways you're guaranteed to have something empty in 10 years. So I went up and down there, and I knew all the – I talked to a lot of the people in North Georgia, and they had nowhere to go. A lot of them didn't want to live in Atlanta, which was actually doing quite well. But mostly they just didn't know what to do. And it was interesting. It reminded me of one of those, as they say, same as it ever was situations. And I wrote this one, and I think I'm going to do this, and then – John has, if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them. If there are no questions, I will, I'll make up some answers for the non-questions. Well, I'm a man, baby. Baby, I'm a man. Roll up my sleeves and I do the best I can, but I'm drowning in a river. Bad paper coming due. Got the North Georgia waters rising, ain't no way to save your money blues. Well, the governor's in a big house somewhere up the line. Family is so perfect, they don't look a thing like mine. And the president don't come around here, he just reads about us in the news. And those North Georgia waters rising, ain't no way to save your money blues. Well, you can pray to Jesus, hope that he comes through, but you know you're never gonna lose. Those North Georgia waters rising, ain't nowhere to see your money blue. About time that I rolled and I rambled somewhere else down the line. I could tell you I got trouble, but you got trouble too. And those North Georgia waters rising, ain't nowhere to save your money blue. Well, you can pray to Jesus, hope that he comes through, but you know you're never gonna lose. Those North Georgia waters rising, ain't nowhere to save your money blue. North Georgia waters rising, ain't no way to save your money blue.
Thanks. Thank you.
Oh, good, we're on. So, if you have comments or questions, I'd love to hear them. I can always throw a couple or two Nathan's way as well. But comments or questions, I'll bring the mic around to you so that we get you on the recording. Comments or questions from anybody?
I will sing the answer back.
Actually, I'm going to hold you to an encore for one time later. Before we all get out of here, which is I don't do this for work, I do this for work. I mean, I don't do this for love, I do this for love.
Also, don't do it for work either.
You don't do it for work. So I'm coming around.
You got that right.
Any questions or comments? You know, that's, you know, you set me up by saying, you know, you probably won't have any questions or comments. Let me ask you one thing, just because of the fact that to fight potentially over this. I'm not necessarily going to argue that there is nobility in work per se always, but one thing is that our daily work at Daily Lives was founded, you know, almost 25 years ago now, or 25 years ago, on the whole notion that it's interesting how much work is a larger part of our love, life than love. We
yes.
spend more time
yeah.
at work than we do with our families, more time than we do at our hobbies. And people demarcate non-work time and work time. And it's interesting how much that's now bled, because a lot of people, there is no such thing anymore as kind of non-work time. But in saying that, why do you think, as a singer-songwriter, that you actually do write songs about work? Why do you think it ends up as not necessarily the only core theme, but a core theme of a lot of what you do?
It's a pretty big core theme. Some of it has to do with an accident of discovering that all the writing I really felt connected to as a young man, Steinbeck, of course, Studs Terkel, and the things that I cared about had to do with labor rather than love. And plus, this is going to sound funny, I don't give love much of a rational position in my life. I've always felt that it was a strictly emotional moment. But in work, there are many, you make decisions. I mean, unless you're just very, very, very unusual, as you go through your life, you have a number of times when you turn a corner and you can choose which fork you take. And work is one of those funny places where you make these decisions. Most of the musicians I know who've been successful, I might not have been one anyway, but when I went to Nashville in 91, the message was clear. I could do that or I could do a life. And they had no interest whatsoever in my wanting to balance that. And they didn't want, I mean, my wife was expected, my wife Leslie, who, you know, so is more sophisticated, more talented, and more intellectually, I don't know, clear than anybody I know, was expected to come to parties and be my wife. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm the world's greatest feminist. I was raised in a patriarchal society with casual misogyny, and I've had to learn just like everybody else. But I certainly wasn't the kind of guy who wanted his wife to come along just to be there, right? And when you would go to things in Nashville that were part of the business to be a professional writer, to be a professional songwriter, the women were expected to not participate in that part. And they still aren't. The only good thing about the internet business for music is that it has made it very demoralizing for misogynists. You know, they can't quite pull the levers like they used to. And eventually that will be one of the best things that happened. So what I'm saying is that I wrote about work because I'm interested in the choices people make. And I knew that my choices had made me a much happier person. Not a famous person and not a wealthy person, but a happier person. Right.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Bob?
As you talk about your biography throughout your songs, I know you lived in Tennessee, you've
yeah.
worked in Georgia, you grew up in Iowa, but it seems like you have a connection to East Lansing. Something about this place somehow, I don't know, keeps drawing you back or something.
It does.
Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I feel comfortable in, it's odd, I've become comfortable in the South. It took a while. The South is an odd bird. What you see in the news about the South has a lot less to do with the South than actually living there. The South is a perfect example of individuals are wonderful, groups are a pain in the ass, right? There's nothing more like it. I like this area. I've always liked the industrial areas because, oddly enough, both my father and I were interested in work, machines, advancements. For a family of smart-ass writers, it was also a family of people more interested in the other parts of the world than other writers. And East Lansing has a weird combination of hyper-intellectualism and a real connection to the roots of labor in America. So it just happens to be one of those places where I feel very much at home, except on Saturday night on a football Saturday, where I feel old and in the way.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Hands in the air. I've got one back there.
That's two
Michael.
Hands. That could be two questions.
See, this is an exercise program.
Say a little bit about the experience of the gap between reality and expectation between the following two groups. People who've seen better times and people who are growing up now into that environment of $10 an hour jobs. And
when my son turned 16, he wanted to get a job. But you can't get a job where you used to get jobs because they're held by people with three kids, right? I mean, when we were younger, when I was younger, there were a million places to make fries, you know? You made your bones by doing the fries or doing the taco shells, and you got scarred on your arms, and then you got a job on the counter, right? And that was way better than making the fries. And then you got the hell out of there and got a real life, right? And my son couldn't get a job. He eventually ended up working in a pizza place, but he was 18 when he finally got the job. And it was very frustrating for him. My daughter, you know, she ran into the same thing. She really couldn't get a job as a high school kid. And she walked right into basically the worst adult jobs that we have now, surrounded by people that she could see were never going to go anywhere. And it weren't bad people. They just, there's nowhere to go. I will say the millennials are impressive. I don't know why people don't like them. They're phenomenal. They've accepted the new work world. They understand that what they're doing today might have nothing to do with what they're doing in 10 years. It doesn't really bother them. They don't give a crap what people do with their personal lives. I mean, if we survive this crap, we're in good shape, right? But what I like to say is that I think there's hope. I think our generation, my generation, probably escaped a little bit. The generation below us really took a beating, and I think they're never going to be the same. I think it's a demoralizing thing to happen. But I think that the millennials, and this is from having millennials as children, I think the millennials will bring the country back to some sanity. And I think the immigrant population has fought too damn hard to be here. I don't think they're going to let the country fall apart either. So I think the irony of this is I think that the populations that are most disparaged by the current governance are the populations that will save us. And I sincerely hope I get to see it, but I believe it's going to happen. And I think we will have someday government involvement in the things that make it possible to live your life with one job, you know, or two jobs, but not four jobs and not working at a McDonald's. So when I travel around and talk to people, if they're under 25, they seem very hopeful. If they're in that 25 to 45 range, they really do seem broken. And I don't know what the fix for that is. I know when I tour in Europe, there are a lot of people doing what I do for a living because they don't have to pay for health care the same way. Honestly, I think people in Europe have figured out that you don't need as much shit, right? I mean, they really do. And cheap public transportation is a big answer. So to the answer to that question, I hope. A lot of the people I write about are people my age or a little bit younger because it's easier to write honestly about problems than it is to write when everything's going great. And that's one of the reasons why Irish music is so good, because it's so goddamn sad. And the Dutch tell me my songs aren't quite sad enough yet. So, but you know, you get my point, right? That there's an optimism in writing about things that there's hope at the end of that are broken, and everything else is a rocky top.
You know, Michael,
you can quote me on that too.
Just a quick aside, you might know or not know that, you know, the kind of expectations that you're talking about in Europe, the earlier generation in Europe ran into a situation where when they were asked, what do you do, which we often respond, oh, you know, I'm a professor, or I'm a steel worker, or I work for the phone company, or whatever the case may be, they would automatically go straight to what they do for fun. Because they did not want to get defined by what they do in terms of employment. And I think that when I look at my own children, you know, boys are 28 and Katie's 31, I'm finding a lot of that optimism, but also kind of there's a post-loyalty moment that's going on in America, that employers don't feel any loyalty to their employees. And I think, conversely, that a lot of workers do not necessarily believe that they're going to be staying at the phone company for even a year, let alone 20, or you know, the kind of pattern that many of us uh, were born into following our fathers or mothers into specific kind of workplaces. So I think it's an interesting moment. I think the question is an interesting one. With that, what I'm going to do is two things. Number one is going to invite you all back across the street October 1st for Mark Auslander, and the rest of the ones are in October over there. November 23rd, we're back in this room for Windborne, which is an a cappella group that does protest and struggle music. So that will be very interesting to have them here at our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. If you didn't sign in, the sign-in sheet is back on the table. And I would commend to you that a number of Nathan's CDs are available for sale. And so that's one of those things that always helps out singer-songwriters. With that, why don't you take us out with I do this for love.
And I wanted to say one last thing. I answer these questions kind of hesitantly, although I'm a little more verbose than I should be, I think. But we come from a family. We used to say our dinner table was the Catskills. And if you could make my mom laugh, you were allowed to eat. And when my wife, Leslie, who comes from as waspy a background as you can come from, a quiet, dinner table, she came to our house and she said, "That's ridiculous." She said, I don't really understand how you people eat. Because she spent her time with her face buried in her food laughing and couldn't eat. And she said, "This is just weird." And I said, "Well, at my table, there's a statue of Shecky Green, And but what I wanted to say was I answer these questions fully aware that I'm a white male. And in this society today, I think we truly do bear some of the responsibility for fixing it because we sure screwed it up. And my daughter, who started as a chemistry major at Elon University in North Carolina, we knew she'd be a chemistry major maybe 3 weeks. And she turned very quickly into a political science, women's studies, classics major, and she is, I watch her in action. And to John's point, she doesn't want to be defined by her work. On the other hand, she refuses to be defined by what people tell her she's supposed to be. Yet she has a strong sense of responsibility. And I think that's a great blend. When I was a kid, honestly, I did a lot of stuff because that's the way you did it. I don't really question it. For a guy who questions in his writing, I didn't question, you get a job, you keep your job. So there are a lot of jobs I held a year past I should have gotten out of them because I had a job, right? I was paying the bills. So she wouldn't do that. She'd be like, they don't treat me well. And I don't mean they make me come to work. I've had those people. But it's pretty impressive. And so to this song, it'll make perfect sense to you, I think. And thank you for having me and listening to me. And I do have a connection to East Lansing. And I almost bought a sandal shop. Did. Remember? It'd be out of business now if I bought it. You see me on a freighter up the Saginaw River, on a bridge outside Youngstown, pouring concrete. Westbound locomotive where the tracks go on forever, and the whole world hums beneath my feet. You hear me pounding nails on a roof in Lafayette, or singing through a bar at 2 a.m. A shrimp boat in an oaring rain, pulling in the nets, tearing all the skin off of my hands. Everything I do, I write another love song to you. Darkness on an imaginary line, rifle tight against my shoulder.
We're flying over the waves off the coast of Carolina, high up where the air is thin and cold. Everything I do, I write another love song to you. I'll be the strongest man you'll ever know. I'll be the bravest man you'll ever know. With everything I do, I write another love song. To you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, John. Sound was great. Thank you for the sound and everything else. Thanks.